Are you someone who uses cannabis as part of your lifestyle? If so, I wonder if this resonates with you. You want to enjoy a mellow unwind with some cannabis, but you can't stand that your high is constantly being tainted by physical discomfort from binge eating. You swear this will finally be the night that you don't eat out of control. But once you have the savory snack, you have to go for sweet, then back to savory, and so it goes until the next thing you know, your stomach feels real funky from a mix of lots of different foods. If you wish that there is a way to enjoy the experience of using cannabis without the unwanted side effects of out-of-control eating, you will not want to miss the Cannabis and Intuitive Eating Workshop. On Thursday, April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific, I'm hosting a workshop to teach you exactly how to navigate intuitive eating while under the influence of cannabis. Get $15 off when you use code PODCAST at checkout. Head to the link in the show notes to learn more and enroll.
If even one time today you ask yourself, what do I need right now? And you listen, you are on the path.
Welcome to Shoulders Down, a podcast about intuitive eating and living. I'm your host, Leah Kern, and I'm an anti-diet dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor. In this podcast, you will learn to harness your body's innate wisdom to govern not just how you eat, but also how you live. It is my mission to help you heal your relationship with food and body so you can live your most aligned and fulfilling life. Welcome, and I'm so glad that you're here. Hello, and welcome back to Shoulders Down. I hope you're having a good day, week, month. I don't know. It's always like, how do I start these things? I'm like sitting here just like laughing to myself. Anyway, I hope you're doing well. This week, we are going to skip listener question again. So if you're new here, usually we do a listener question before the podcast episode, but things have been pretty busy for me. I am so excited to share with you why things have been so busy really soon. If you want to make sure that you are first to know about the thing I've been working on behind the scenes, this new offering that I think is really first of all, it's an incredible value from an investment standpoint, but also something that is really accessible if one-to-one coaching has not felt accessible to you for whatever reason, the time, the financials. You are definitely going to want to make sure you get on my email list so that you can stay in the loop about this new offering that is coming. So the link to get on my email list is in the show notes. Make sure to subscribe and make sure to check for the welcome email. Sometimes it goes to spam. It's annoying that it does that, but it happens often with these kind of like email provider systems. So you can either drag it from like promotions or spam to your primary inbox, or you can add me as a contact, my email, leah@leahkernrd. This is all when you click the link in the show notes that it will explain this. So I can't wait to share more about that. I've really been working hard behind the scenes to bring this to life for you. And I'm just so excited to have this offering. I think it will just make intuitive eating, health at every size, these frameworks so much more accessible. And I cannot wait to share with you more of the details soon. So today we have Dr. Diana Gordon on the podcast. She is a licensed psychologist, and her and I got connected in such a fun way. We talk about this a little in the beginning of the episode, but I'll just share it again here. So I posted the link to my podcast on cannabis and intuitive eating on a intuitive eating Facebook group for all the certified intuitive eating counselors, because I know it's something that there is not that much information on. A lot of people are scared to talk about it, but a lot of clients, a lot of people who are learning intuitive eating have questions on it. And it's something that people deserve support on. Not everyone has the privilege to just like ignore that if cannabis is a part of their world for whatever reason, whether it's for chronic pain or anxiety or just recreation. It can really impact your relationship with food. And so that's why I started creating content on this like rather taboo topic, though it's like 2022 and it's really baffling to me that it's still taboo to talk about cannabis. But anyway, that's a side note. So Dr. Diana Gordon commented on the post on the Certified Intuitive Eating Counselor Facebook group saying, like, you know, thank you for creating this kind of content. She practices in California and it's something that comes up with her clients a lot, being that California is a state where cannabis has been legal for quite some time. So anyway, her and I got connected on Instagram and we started talking and we just really had a nice energy flow, natural connection, authentic connection. And I so loved our conversation on the podcast. It's a kind of a long one. So I think that's another reason why it's great to skip listener questions so we can just dive right into the episode with Dr. Diana Gordon. Okay, so let me read her bio and introduce her, and then we will get into this week's episode. Dr. Diana Gordon is a licensed psychologist, coach, and content creator specializing in intuitive eating and health at every size. She combines evidence-based skills such as mindfulness, cognitive behavioral skills, and other coping tools with intuitive eating principles. As both a psychologist and an intuitive eating certified provider, she offers evaluation and treatment for both eating disorder-related concerns as well as other mental health concerns. As a person of size, she draws on both her personal and professional experience to dismantle fat phobia and to help people live a life free from dieting. Welcome, Diana. So excited to have you on the pod. I love our origin story. I was just thinking, like, before we got on, we literally got connected through a cannabis podcast. So, like, backstory, a few months ago, I shared an episode of the podcast that was about cannabis and binge eating. And I put it on an intuitive eating counselor Facebook group because I was like, I don't hear a lot of people talking about this. And Diana chimed in and was like, yes, thank you.
I was like, yes, this is so valuable. Why has no one else talked about this? I love it.
Yes. And that is the beginning of our friendship, which I think is like a beautiful origin story of like how a beautiful friendship starts over a cannabis and binge eating podcast episode.
Couldn't agree more. I've never had a friendship start that way, but I'm very glad that ours did.
Yes, me too. Well, I'm so excited to chat more today. After our like our initial connection where we like met over Zoom, I'm like, ooh, we have so much to talk about. So I would love to just start by hearing you chat through your story. And we didn't really talk about your story the other day. So I'm excited to hear, what is your story with your relationship with food and body as much as you're comfortable getting into?
Totally. Yeah. So I love sharing my origin story with food and body because I think it's so important for people who are trying to heal their relationship with food and body to really see that even the people that they might look up to who are out there like doing this work professionally and creating content about this, we've all struggled. Like, it's something that affects just about everybody at some point in their lives. For me, sadly, I think I had a disordered relationship with food and body from a very young age. I grew up in a very fat phobic environment with parents who were really deeply steeped in diet culture and their own food and body image concerns. And I started dieting when I was very young, probably 6 or 7 years old. And at that time, I was in a slightly larger body than my peers. And the more that I dieted, the more that my body seemed to grow. And so sometimes I would lose weight and then regain it. Sometimes I would even go on diets and follow them perfectly and still gain weight. I eventually ended up developing eating disorder behaviors, including binging and purging, probably by the time I was in middle school, like 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And when I say this, it really, really strikes me as intense because I have 6-year-old twins. And so I think about, you know, I was this age when I started thinking about my body and about food. And so it's really never too young to sort of consider the impact that this has on people. So anyway, by the time I went to college, I moved really far away from family and friends that I had grown up around who had been immersed in diet culture. And I started to meet other people who were also larger people. And that was really kind of the first time in my life that I started to see other people who were fat, but who were living in their bodies in this like peaceful and accepting way. And I started to think, you know, I wonder if I could make peace with my body because my body doesn't seem to want to shrink. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the first time that I really realized, you know, dieting isn't the path for me because it hasn't worked for me all this time. It's only made things worse on, you know, in so many different ways. So at that time, I discovered intuitive eating. I read the book cover to cover. And I wish I could say it was a totally linear process and I gave up dieting and I made peace with my body. That's definitely not how it happened. I entered into a period where I would do intuitive eating for a while, and then I would kind of relapse into my eating disorder, and then I would come back to intuitive eating. And then by the time I started graduate school in psychology, I finally really committed myself to intuitive eating, kind of did the therapeutic work I needed to do to recover from my own trauma around how I was treated for being fat when I was younger. And I started to really realize that this problem was bigger than me, that like it wasn't just about me and my experience, but also that fat liberation was out there and was a problem for a lot of people. And so I think the way that I was able to really commit myself to do this in my personal work was by really recognizing how many other people were affected and really being connected to the broader community as a whole. So that was kind of my journey. And I love working with people who are in all different stages of this, because I think, you know, as I've said, I've had an eating disorder. I've been an intuitive eater. I've gone back to having an eating disorder. You know, I've dieted, I've stopped dieting, I've gone back to dieting. And so I really see this as a nonlinear process and as something that, you know, people can benefit from doing this work really at any stage of their lives.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing those pieces of your story and the piece about your twin girls being the age that you were when you first started having these body thoughts, these restrictive thoughts, is really powerful, because I see the content you share on Instagram about like allowing them to have the candy and raising them like intentionally as intuitive eaters. And I like to bring that piece up because I just think about the ripple effects of this work. Like, you did this work, you're breaking that inherited chain of body hate and dieting in a family system, and you get to see it like play out in real time with your girls.
Yeah, it's amazing. I feel like, you know, probably my biggest motivation for doing this beyond my own happiness is seeing that exact ripple effect of like not just even my kids, but also my kids' friends and the people they'll interact with. And that the more people who grow up knowing that they don't have to spend their lives dieting, the fewer people in the next generation that are going to be sucked into this. Yeah. You know, diet culture mentality.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I think about like for every person who does this work, okay, there's one less person spewing diet culture propaganda, fat phobia into the world. And then for those people who they touch, you know, like your girls know that like there's nothing wrong with candy or sweets, and like there's nothing wrong with body diversity and all these things. And then they're now fewer people contributing to the greater whole of the diet propaganda in the world. And it just spreads. It's so concrete when you look at it like that.
Yeah, definitely.
That's so beautiful. And then the other piece of your story that I'm so glad you mentioned is like, this isn't linear for everyone. I think so many people have the experience, people who I've had on the podcast and myself included, of reading the book of intuitive eating or getting exposed to it the first time in whatever way that is, and just being like, yep, this is it, and running with it. And I can say in my own story, I mean, I don't know this for certain, but I almost wonder if it's related to like, I benefit from thin privilege, like perhaps healing your relationship with food in a society that will accept the body that you heal into makes it a little bit perhaps it does create less resistance. And I think that's important to name. I'm curious for you, what feels like the piece that when you are in this kind of bargaining phase of like intuitive eating or dieting, what feels like the piece that kind of moved the needle for you to push you into never going back to dieting?
Yeah, I think that the thing that really moved the needle for me was the recognition of the systemic issues that were at play and the ways in which, by continuing to participate in dieting, I was also sort of condoning and playing into a system that I no longer believed in. And so for me, the real key to embracing intuitive eating was embracing health at every size and like really recognizing that the things I had been taught, you know, because I really grew up believing that like, because I was fat, that I was going to like die earlier than other people, that I was going to, you know, get diabetes, that like, you know, I really, you know, bought into that like medical fat phobia. And so I think that for me, learning that that wasn't true was really the thing that gave me permission to accept my body as it was, because I finally was like, oh, okay, so this is all fat phobia. Like, this is not actually a real thing, and I can accept who I am, and maybe I'll get diabetes, maybe I won't, but whether or not I go on a diet isn't going to change that. Mm. you know? Yeah. And so I think that was really the key for me. And so that's the work I often do with people who are in this bargaining phase. Exactly as you said, I think for folks who are recovering into thin bodies, sometimes it can be easier, but for people who are going to recover into larger bodies, like it really becomes this conversation of like, you know, really knowing that like the work, the discomfort of being fat is a discomfort, but it is not all of the things we've been led for it to be, right? Like it isn't all the things we believe it's going to be. And I think that was really freeing for me to discover that.
Yeah. And I love this piece of your story where you're sharing, like in college, you started meeting people in other body sizes who seemed like okay with it. And it's like showing that possibility of like, wait a second, you can be in a body size that, you know, society deems like unacceptable and still find happiness and still find joy and a partner or whatever the things our society says you'll never find. I think seeing examples of that, and I see this with my clients all the time, like whether it's examples in like movies or in real life or like family members, whatever it is, of building proof for your brain that like, no, this body can, I can still experience the things that I've been told I can't experience in this body.
Totally. And I have people like, because I am a larger bodied like content creator in this space, I frequently have people message me on Instagram and say things like, you know, how did you accept the fact that like being fat means, you know, you may have to ask for, you know, a seatbelt extender, or you may not find a partner, or you may not be able to have like satisfying sex and have children. You know, people ask me these questions all the time. And the answer that I give them is that their fears are real, that like fat phobia is real and being fat is hard. And there is really elements of being fat in today's world that are difficult, and that you can either be fat and come to a place of internal acceptance around it and do your best to live the most satisfying, fulfilling life you can, or you can be fat and not do those things. But the third option of not being fat is probably not an option for most of us. You know? Yeah. And so that's kind of the work that I do with people around this. And I think as someone in a larger body, it's maybe easier for me to say that than someone with thin privilege, where I can say, you know, the choice isn't, do I want to be fat or not? The choice is, how do I want to live in my fat body, you know, right, or in my larger body?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I think the lived experience you share recounting your story, your childhood, like you said, it is so like poignantly, like the more you try to shrink yourself, the more you just seemed to go in the opposite direction, which is such a validating kind of like a textbook example of dieting leads to weight gain. Like we have the statistics, right? It's 95% of the time, if not more. And so I think that the way that you respond to people in your DMs or who reach out to you, it's like a moment of tough love, but like a very much needed tough love, because the possibility of the way out being getting into a smaller body is a lie that diet culture feeds us of like, if you're disciplined enough, if you want it bad enough, when really it's like completely ignoring all the other factors that would land someone in a larger body.
Exactly. And that's where I think, you know, like bringing in this systemic viewpoint is so important, because I really want to normalize for people, you know, who are listening to this or who message me or work with me or with you, that like, you know, it is totally okay to not want to be fat. Like most people wouldn't want to be fat if they had a choice, because like being fat in today's world means certain consequences, certain forms of discrimination that we can't escape from. And I think that like when I work with people around acceptance, I'm not trying to say you should love being fat. I'm simply trying to say, let's accept what we can't change, mm-hmm. and let's work on the aspects of our lives that we can change. And I think most importantly, like work on the aspects of the world that make it so difficult to be a fat person in today's world. And that's where I really see like my core mission in doing this work, is really wanting to make the world better for people who are living in larger bodies, and, you know, making it safe for all of us to be who we are and eat. Like we all have a right to still eat and still be happy, whatever it is our body looks like.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's sounding like the social justice element of this work was the piece that, like, when talking about moving the needle, was one of the needle movers on like, oh, me continuing to diet isn't just hurting myself, but it's hurting the greater good of humanity by continuing to participate in like an oppressive system.
Exactly. And I think, you know, as a white woman, you know, looking at a system of oppression, you know, in dieting and fat phobia that has had the biggest impact on people of color, right? On, you know, people who are in marginalized bodies for other reasons, you know, differently abled bodies and things like that. I think when I participate in dieting, like with my privilege and with, you know, even though I am in a larger body, I still hold a lot of other privilege. When I participate in dieting, I am also participating in this system that is oppressing other people even more than it's oppressing me.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. Would you be open to speaking on someone who's listening and they're like, what do you mean the system of dieting is oppressing people who are differently abled and people of color more than it's oppressing, you know, other people? What do you mean when you say that?
Oh, yeah, I would love to talk about that. And I think one of the things I want to say is I, you know, as a white woman and conscious of wanting to center voices of people who do not have my demographics, who have also talked about these topics, I want to really recommend, you know, a couple of resources to people. One is Sabrina String's Fearing the Black Body, and the other is Sonia Renee Taylor's work. I think both of them have written very eloquently on this topic, and I will do my best to summarize that essentially the beauty standards, the beauty ideals that were created for white women, right? That white bodies and thin bodies and, you know, abled bodies were considered normal. And bodies that were different colors and different sizes and had different abilities were not considered normal. And so fat phobia and racism have always been linked, because fat phobia in some ways is a reaction to racism. It's a reaction to how we view bodies that are different than ours, especially bodies that are different colors than ours. And so, and then the other piece that also plays in here is just the intersectionality piece of like the more ways in which we don't hold privilege, the more oppression affects us. And so if you are both a person of color and in a larger body, you're dealing not only with fat phobia, but also with the race event that comes on top of that. And so that's what I mean when I say that people are more affected. And the third piece of that is simply that I'm not in a very large body. And so I'm a person who can walk into clothing stores and sometimes find my size. I'm a person who can sit on an airplane without an extender at this moment in time. And so I'm also, even though I am in a larger body, I have thin privilege relative to some folks who are larger than me, who deal with other forms of institutional fat phobia that I don't deal with.
Right. Yeah. This piece about it can be both, and like you can have certain elements of privilege and also be oppressed by the system that's fat phobic in certain ways as well, is something that comes up often with clients. So I appreciate you bringing that piece up, and I appreciate the book recs. They're both sitting behind me on my shelf, and completely co-sign it. Both of those books are incredible. So shifting gears a little, I'm curious to hear, I always like asking people this, do you remember your first reaction, your initial reaction to either the intuitive eating framework and or the health at every size framework, being that is it is so radically opposite the dieting weight-centric frameworks?
Yeah. Yeah. I love admitting to people that I too, like, I think a lot of people have this reaction. I first read, I was like, wait, this can't really be true. You know, like, this is too good to be true that I could, you know, especially with intuitive eating. I remember reading the book and thinking like, it can't be that simple. You know, like it can't be that simple that I can simply eat what I want in quantities that feel satisfying to me, and my body will do what my body is going to do. And I think especially with intuitive eating, the thing that I couldn't believe could be true was that I could maintain my weight without any like effort or exertion on my part, right? Because I always used to say like I was either gaining or losing weight. Like those were the two states I was in, you know? Like weight maintenance wasn't even a thing for me, you know? And so I think with intuitive eating, that was my first reaction, was like, wow, this feels too good to be true. But also it felt like this actually makes a lot of sense. You know, like it actually makes a lot of sense. And I think my view on health at every size, I think I also was skeptical, but the more research that I did, and this is why like I encourage people to like go out there and educate themselves, because if you actually go look at the primary literature, like the studies that have established these principles, like you will see that the data is very strong, you know? Yeah. And I'm trained in interpreting data. Like that's one of the things I do as a psychologist that I trained in my doctoral program for. And when I actually looked at that data, I was like, yeah, like this totally makes sense. But I think having a skeptical reaction initially is totally reasonable, especially because right. Like we've all been told this stuff for a really long time.
Right. Yeah. That cognitive dissonance that comes up is like, it takes a while to grapple with. Like it's so uncomfortable to just uproot and overturn everything you've been led to believe for decades in many cases. And that's a process. So
I like that you said you like admitting that, that like even you, and same here, like I was skeptical at first too. And there, all the questions that come up of like, oh, it's too easy. How could this be possible? But I love what you're saying. Like, look at the research, you know, it's like, I find myself saying this so often on the podcast that the proof is in the pudding. I'm like, I don't know where right. the line came from, but I'm saying it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you don't have to take our word for it or anyone's word for it, because like, you can look at the research. And I think similarly, I tell people like, look at the research on the other side of like, if you go to a doctor and they tell you to lose weight, like ask the doctor, like, can you show me any studies that show that, you know, weight loss helps with my condition? You know, I mean, they can't.
Right. And if they do, if they can produce a study, what's the legitimacy of the study design? Are there ulterior, a company funding it with ulterior motives? Like all of these things that then come up.
Right. And then like, do they follow up in 2 years to see if the people who really, you know, supposedly reduced their blood pressure or whatever, did they keep the weight off, keep their blood pressure down?
Exactly.
Or were they right back where they started 2 years later, you know? Yeah. So I think like that, I think asking for the receipts in this case is a very reasonable thing to do. And I think the receipts are there.
The receipts are there. Yeah. And what I think what I would want to add, aside from look at the research, is look at your own lived experience. Like what has dieting brought you, you know, like has it brought you any more peace, any more health? Has it brought you like better labs, or has it only brought you more stress, anxiety, and probably increased weight gain?
Right. Exactly. You know, I tell people like, you know, I've worked with people in their 50s and 60s who have been fat their entire lives, who have dieted and lost weight and gained weight. And, you know, I say the same thing. I'll say, you know, like, if, you know, if it worked, right, like, would you be here, right? Like, would you be in my office at this point in your life after having tried all these different things?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So many other topics I want to get into with you. So as we shared in the beginning of this episode, you and I originally bonded over the topic of cannabis and intuitive eating, a very underrepresented, spoken about topic. Mm-hmm. So being that you're located in California, you shared like this is something you encounter with clients. So I thought it'd be nice to chat about it a little bit more beyond the episode that I've already recorded. So if you're listening to this and you're like, cannabis and intuitive eating, I want to hear more, you can check out that episode. But what Diana said, like we chatted about, she said she would expand on, and I think it's a great point, is how using cannabis can bring up emotions that aren't always present when sober, which can lead to emotional eating combined with like the munchie situation. So I want to first, before we even go any further, talk about emotional eating and talk about why it gets a bad reputation.
Yeah, totally. So every time hashtag post emotional eating on Instagram, I think to myself, I hate the phrase emotional eating, and I only use it because diet companies use it. And so I want people who are searching for that to find my work and not like, you know, Weight Watchers. But yeah, so the way that I think about emotional eating quite simply is that like, I definitely think the bad rep comes from diet culture. Like in diet culture, there's this sort of unspoken or sometimes spoken belief that like, you can only eat for the right reason. And if you eat for anything other than the right reason, then you're wrong and you're bad and you're doing it all wrong and it's a disaster, right? Mm-hmm. And so the question I have is thinking, what is the right reason to eat? You know, being hungry is a great reason to eat. But I also don't think there's anything inherently wrong with choosing to eat for other reasons. And one of those might be that you're having difficult emotions. And I think that when we make it wrong, like when we tell ourselves, I can't eat when I'm stressed out, or I can't eat when I'm sad, and we berate ourselves for it. You know, we're anxious and we're eating and we're thinking, oh, what's wrong with me? I can't believe I'm doing this. What happens then? Well, we feel worse, right? The emotions are heightened by this like cycle of guilt and restriction, right? And then typically when we feel worse, we eat more, we eat faster, we eat less mindfully and less thoughtfully. And so we start to feel kind of out of control. And so when I think about emotional eating and when I use the phrase, what I think about is that cycle, like that cycle of like restricting ourselves, feeling guilty, eating more, you know, and sort of buying into that whole like diet culture mentality of like, I'm so defective because I wanted to eat a cookie because I was anxious.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of that's what I think about is, you know, why emotional eating has a bad rap, not because like eating inherently is bad for you.
Right. Yeah. I love how you start off by saying that diet culture kind of like gives this idea that there are right and wrong reasons to eat, and that in itself creates shame for wanting to turn to food emotional. And something too is like food is emotional. Like when you are younger and you're crying or something, like you might get a bottle. And so then it's like, okay, it's a soothing thing. Like it naturally is linked. I love the example of like when a child's like sports team or something, like when the team wins and they go for ice cream, like it's like it is emotional in our world. It's like, oh, these happy feelings and like the ice cream is celebratory, like it does get linked. So it's like, why are we trying to not link it when that's just part of how humans relate to food and have for a long time?
Yeah, you know, I think often in parenting people say like never give your kids food rewards, and I think first of all, the people who say that definitely do not have kids, because I don't know a single person who has kids who does not ever bribe their kids with food. Like if you have found another way, I beg you, message me and tell me what it is, because I really think that a lot of people occasionally use food as a reward. But then I think beyond that, I completely agree with what you're saying about the celebratory nature of food. And like in my kids' class, you know, they have a marble jar, and when they fill it up, they get an ice cream party. And so we are not going to somehow conceal from our children that food is a pleasurable experience that you can use to reward yourself. Like, so I think if we're kidding ourselves that we're going to do that, then again, we're sort of stigmatizing something that's perfectly natural.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. And in your explanation, the stigmatizing of it is what then creates the shame spiral and, you know, the experience of feeling out of control and all these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So if emotional eating gets a bad rep in diet culture, why is emotional eating, I mean, we already started talking about this, but like, why is it not necessarily a bad thing?
Oh, I love this question. Yeah. So, you know, as a therapist, I generally take the position that the more tools we have in our toolkit for coping with strong feelings, the better. You know, we've all had days where we feel like we've tried everything, we still feel terrible. So I feel like the more things just at baseline that we have that we can try, the better, because sometimes you need it, right? Sometimes we go through really hard stuff and we need to have a lot of coping skills at our beck and call. And so I think of eating as just being one of the things we can keep in our kit. When we think about it this way, as kind of being one tool of many, I think it takes away some of the guilt and shame we may feel around choosing to use it, because it's like, okay, well, I could choose to call a friend, I could choose to go for a walk, I could choose to have a snack, and there's no emotional valence that's attached to any one of those options. And so suddenly it becomes kind of part of this buffet and this really kind of beautiful way that we can care for ourselves. I think that when we are feeling distressed and we respond to our own needs by soothing ourselves, it's actually a really beautiful way that we can bond like with ourselves. We can build our confidence in ourselves and in our coping skills and feel like, you know, I'm not going to ignore my distress. I'm not going to try to mask it. I'm not going to try to push it away. I'm going to actually respond to it and honor it and treat it just the way we would someone else in our lives who was distressed, right? Instead of being like, stop being upset, we would try to help them. And I think we can take the same stance towards ourselves. And so when we have that kind of compassionate viewpoint, the thought of eating a snack, it just feels like, oh, that's just like an act of self-care. It's not, you know, some weak, awful thing that I'm doing.
Yeah. I personally cannot stand the advice when someone's like, oh, I want to like, I'm having a hard day and I want to turn to food. And like, I can't stand this advice I sometimes see on social media of like, just go for a walk or take a bath. And it's like, no, sometimes you want ice cream or like a snack, and like that is okay. And I think the advice of like just trying to like throw something else on it to ignore like the thing that like you really are wanting is just like dismissive. And what I like to suggest to clients is like do both, like have ice cream and call a friend, you know, go for a walk and, you know, go have your that comforting mac and cheese or whatever the meal is. And when I think about that, it's like, the food might not actually be meeting the root of the need. It might be more of like a soothing thing, but like journaling or calling a friend or something like that might actually help you address the root, but the two can go together. It's not like you only have to choose one.
Right. Exactly. And I think, you know, when I think about, you know, interventions for helping people feel better, I feel like there's different levels of intervention, exactly as you're talking about, right? there are things that on the surface level are going to address the symptom in the moment. And then there are things that are going to come closer to addressing the root cause. You know, maybe more things like talking to a friend, going for a walk, you know, making an extra appointment with your therapist, taking a psychiatric medication. Like, there are other things that might help to address root causes. But self-soothing is a well-known evidence-based technique that's been used in, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy for years and years. And self-soothing really comes from like focusing on these surface level things that we can do in the moment to help ourselves. You know, in DBT, they call it like surviving the moment. Mm. And you kind of have to survive the moment before you can figure out why the moment happened, you know? And yeah. So when you're having a moment and you need to survive it, self-soothing with food can be a great strategy for helping you regulate yourself. And I often will tell people, you know, when you're a 10 out of 10 on the distress scale, you're not going to like pull out your phone and start doing a meditation app. You know, I don't do that when I'm a 10 out of 10 on the distress scale. I don't think anything.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But you might be able to like, you know, eat, you know, a couple bites of something soothing, or you might be able to like, you know, roll on some essential oils if that's soothing for you, or light a candle or take a shower. You might try one of these sort of surface level self-soothing things. And then once your distress gets down to like a 6 or a 7 out of 10, then you might think, okay, what could I do that might help me shift out of this more completely? And I think that's when those interventions like taking a bath help. And I think that often when we try that first, we sort of experience it the way a child experiences it when like a parent or a teacher sort of shuts them down and tells them like, stop feeling that, you know, get back on track. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how we want to treat ourselves, you know?
Yeah, this is so interesting. I've never really heard this concept of like there being varying levels of distress and like therefore varying levels of options like that you might choose depending on where you're at. Because yeah, it just, maybe that's why, as you're explaining this, like that's why it feels so mismatched to me when someone just suggests like go for a walk or like, you know, take a bath, but you're like in a place where you're like, are you kidding? Like that's like so inaccessible right now. And that you're the language you're giving to it is helping me make sense of why that is.
Yeah, I think, you know, just like we would meet someone else where they're at, we also have to meet ourselves where we're at. And we have to be able to recognize when our distress level is high enough that we need a really basic intervention versus when we're ready to do something that's a little bit more involved.
Right. So for someone who's listening and they're like, okay, you're saying I can have a snack if I'm distressed. I can turn to food emotionally. But when I do that, it's like a shit show. Like it's like, you know, all cabinets are flying. Like it's like, it's a mess. Why is it that turning to food emotionally in the context of like a diet culture background versus turning to food emotionally in the intuitive eating approach and framework, how is it that they can look different?
I think that it really comes down to intention and mindfulness, frankly. Like I think that the intention that we are going into an action with, I think plays a big role in how it affects us. Mm-hmm. Like different behaviors can affect us differently depending on what the intention is behind them, the thoughtfulness is behind it. And so I think about an emotional eating kind of binge that might happen in the context of diet culture, where it's like you started thinking about what you were going to eat when you got home from this really stressful day at work at like, you know, 1:30, 2 o'clock, you know, like your boss went off on you in a meeting. You started thinking about it. Your agitation is rising and you're thinking, okay, I'm going to go home. I'm going to eat this mac and cheese and I'm going to feel better. Right. And so one of the things that happens when we do that is rather than necessarily trying to like cope with our feelings in the present moment, we're casting them aside. We're pushing them aside. We're like waiting until later to deal with it. And so it's like I always think about like, I have like an Instant Pot. If anyone out there has a pressure cooker, they're thinking this. I always think about like, that's like when you hit the quick release on the Instant Pot and like the steam starts like, you know, busting out of it, right? So like you get home, you hit the pressure release and you're just like going through your cabinets, ransacking them, looking for food. Yeah, you're not going to feel good after doing that, right? Like it's extremely dysregulated. But I think about it another way where let's say you have the same exact scenario, like you have a lunchtime meeting with your boss, they're kind of rude to you where they give you a bad performance review. And you think, wow, this is a really difficult day. I am really, really feeling this emotionally. What do I need right now to help me feel better? You know, and maybe in that moment, think, you know what, I'm going to walk down to the corner and get myself like one of those giant muffins they have at that coffee shop. I love drinking that with a latte in the afternoon. That would feel so good to me right now. You go downstairs, you know, you get that and you go back to your desk and you eat it and you really do it with this intention of like, I'm going to soothe myself. I'm going to help myself feel better. I bet when you go home that night, maybe you'll have mac and cheese and maybe you won't, but either way, you're not going to have the pressure release because you've already kind of dealt with the emotion. And so that's what I see as different is like this intentionality. And I think in mindfulness, I talk about like there's power in the pause. And so if we can just take a second and pause before we eat emotionally, and I will sometimes recommend to people that they write down the question on a pad of paper in front of them, what do I need right now?
I love that.
You know, or say it out loud to yourself, whatever works for you, and really give your brain the space to answer that question. Yeah. What does it want? Does it want mac and cheese? Great. Does it want to meditate? Great. Does it want to walk? Great. But I think really pausing and saying, you know, what do I need right now? Yeah. And that can really change the tenor
right
before you start opening the cabinet. That can really change the tenor of it. Mm. And then whatever it is, like if it's a snack, great. Like go make that snack for yourself, put it on a plate, sit down and eat it and really enjoy it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm hearing from you from like the two different scenarios is one, there is no intention. You're not like, I'm going to go like make myself something soothing. It's just like, I am unconsciously upset and I don't know why. And like food is so restricted. So like, this will bring me joy of finally like having this thing, but it's like all very, it seems like from I'm putting myself in those shoes, like very autopilot-y and there's this therefore lack of intention in terms of using food to soothe. Whereas from the intuitive eater's perspective, it's I'm having a hard day. I also heard self-compassion. Yeah, this is hard. The self-compassion and coupled with the pause of like, what do I need? Okay, if I need food, cool, great. I'm going to go get myself a muffin or whatever it is. Tending to your needs in like a timely manner, like you said, instead of like the pressure cooking, building up. And also like the non-judgment about like having a muffin isn't a bad thing. Therefore, like it prevents the further shame spiral.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really about intention. I think the more that I, you know, the thing that I have really taken away from my own mindfulness practice, like in the last 10 years or so that I've been trying to practice mindfulness at times more adherently than others. The thing that I've really taken away from it is just that when I can slow down, I make better decisions. I think that's probably true of most people. And more so when I can slow down, I am more aware. I can hear my intuition when I take a second. That's why I say like write down the question, like what do I need right now? You know, and really commit yourself to doing whatever it is that answer is. I think it really helps me to recognize like the more that I slow down and I behave with intention, the more I'm able to respond to my needs because it tunes out the noise. I can really hear what my intuition is asking for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think about too, every time you ask yourself what you need and then you honor the need, it is building trust with your body because your body's like, cool, you listen to us, you ask what we need, you honor our needs versus coming from a history of never listening to what your body needs because you're instead listening to the calorie tracking app or whatever rules you've been prescribed and how much that tarnishes trust with your body versus every time you say, what do you need? And you give it what it needs. It's like, okay, you give us what we need.
Totally. And I think, you know, oftentimes people ask me like, well, what is like the single, like, what is like the best thing that I can do to start like working towards becoming, you know, more intuitive or more in touch? And what I often tell them is I tell them every single time that you listen to yourself about what you need, whether that thing, because intuitive eating is a self-care framework. Like it's not just about food, right? It's also about like, what do we need to take care of ourselves? And so the more practice that you get, like dropping in and saying, what do I need right now? And meeting your need, the more that you start to rebuild that trust that's been lost that we all lose with our bodies because we're all following these external sets of rules. Then you add on the layers of like, you know, in my own history, I've talked about like my trauma around like fat phobia. So when I respond to my own needs compassionately, I rebuild trust with myself. And that also helps with my emotion regulation and my coping. So I really think this process of like every single time you listen to yourself, you are becoming more of an intuitive eater. And I want people to know that, even the people out there who feel like, oh my God, like I am like, you know, I'm really struggling with intuitive eating. Like I'm not doing it right. If even one time today you ask yourself, what do I need right now? And you listen, you are on the path towards becoming more in alignment with your intuition. And that's really what it takes, is rebuilding that trust.
Yeah. And it's a slow burn. It's many, many, many times, many times a day asking that question, not only asking the question, but honoring the information that comes up. It takes so many times of doing that to eventually get to this place. But like you're saying, every time is like a worthwhile time. It's a worthwhile kind of rep of the muscle of flexing the muscle of dropping in.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I love that. I think that will be really helpful for people because it lets them know that like you don't have to go from A to Z in one day. Like there are these little stepwise things you can do that will support where you're at right now and will ultimately be building blocks for eventually getting to a place where you do trust yourself and you are able to listen to your intuition. I think
it's
such a helpful step for anyone right now.
Yeah. And I still remember like when I first started doing my intuitive eating work, I worked with an intuitive eating dietitian who's amazing. And the first assignment that she gave me in terms of my own relationship with food was, she asked, could you try this week just once or twice to have what you really want for breakfast? Like just to ask yourself, like, what do I really want? And then to eat it. And I remember at the time thinking like, oh God, yeah. But then there's like breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, binges, you know what I mean? Like what, like there's a lot to work on here. But I think that starting in that way, when I got breakfast under my belt, then I started working on lunch and then dinner. And so I really worked on it in this like stepwise fashion. And that's what I encourage clients to do. And for some people are ready like to go all in, and some people aren't. And it's totally okay wherever you're at, you know?
Yeah. I love that advice from that dietitian. And I definitely do something similar. I'm like, what do you want? Like, let's like get like one thing in your pantry that you actually enjoy. And it's not coming from this outside pressure of like, I should be having it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that. So shifting gears a little, I loved our conversation the other day off mic, or maybe the other week, about the intersection of spirituality and intuitive eating. So this is a topic, as you and I spoke about the other day, that can sometimes get a little sketchy, where it's like spirituality on social media can be this like, it's all about manifesting your reality, completely ignoring like systemic oppression and all these things. But you and I had this beautiful conversation about like the work of intuitive eating can be seen as spiritual. So I'd love to hear you chat through, first of all, do you feel intuitive eating is spiritual work? And if so, like how or why?
Yeah. So I consider intuitive eating, in my own experience of it, to be deeply spiritual work. And I say my own experience because I think that we all get to define what is spiritual for us, and we all get to find our own meaning and spiritual practices that are meaningful for us. Like I take that the tradition of Reformed Judaism, of like looking at every tradition and saying like, does this enhance my relationship with my higher power? And so that's how I think about spirituality in general, that we all get to decide like what is spiritual for us. However, in my experience, I think it might be the most spiritual thing I've ever done, was healing my relationship with food and my body. There's really nothing more spiritual than like getting into alignment with your intuition and really feeling like grounded in that like deeply felt sense of like, I know what's best for me and my body. Like I have that divine wisdom, so I don't need to look for that from any sort of like outside source. Like I don't need to input all my food into like my calorie tracking app so that someone can tell me whether or not I've like done today correctly, right? Because I'm in alignment with my own wisdom and my own attunement. And that's all that matters to me. So that's how I see it as being spiritual, is that like we are really getting in touch with like, we're stripping away all of this external stuff and really getting in touch with like what it is that we want and what really feeds and nourishes us. I also think that it's spiritual in that becoming more confident in ourselves, like in our relationship with food, in our relationship with our bodies, is in often for my, both me and a lot of my clients, it's a pathway towards living more authentically, like in all areas of life. Mm-hmm. Because if you are spending your life trying to shrink or change your body, then you are putting a lot of time and resources into trying to be a thing that you're actually not. And so when you get into whatever your body really is, right? Like when you eat intuitively, you kind of settle into your natural body shape and size. That is a way in which you're living authentically. You know, you're living in alignment with who you really are. And I think that when you do that, there's so much power in that. And I noticed that shift in myself. Like once I started to just sort of live as a larger person and I was unapologetic about being large and being who I am, I started to like re-examine other areas of my life in which I wasn't fully living my truth. And once I started like listening to myself and making my own rules, I really couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. And so it's transcended into so many different areas of life. So I think that's also a deeply spiritual practice, is getting in touch with who you are in all aspects of life.
Yeah, I love this topic. And I couldn't agree more with everything you just shared. What is more spiritual than being your authentic self? Like you were put on in this planet, you somehow found your way into this dimension. Like we, none of us know really how or why, but we are here and we have inner wisdom and inner whispers about like what feels right to do and act and eat in the time that we're here. Listening to those things brings you closer to your authentic self, which like you're saying, allows you to expand into your most like expansive version of yourself, which allows you to touch others. And like, then there's the ripple of like your children and social justice. And all of that is, to me, just to echo everything you're saying, so deeply spiritual.
Yeah. Yeah. I think being in this like intuitive eating, anti-diet world and kind of being part of the community and being part of, you know, this effort to change the way people see people as size, the way people see eating and diet culture. I think the other aspect of spirituality is that, like, you know, it helps to recognize that we are all connected in this way and that, like, what I do affects other people, just like what other people do affects me. And I think that so often, like, dieting is so much about us. Like, it's so much about, like, you as an individual. Like, what does your butt look like? What does your stomach look like? Yes. Right? Like, you know, how much weight did you lose this week? Right? And I think that when you get into, like, the anti-diet world, it suddenly becomes about everybody else. It becomes about, God, like, this is so messed up that we have all collectively been brought into this system together. Yeah. And so I think that's the other like spiritual component of it, is realizing the ways in which we're all interconnected and like, you know, taking responsibility for the ways in which the decisions that we make do affect the world, you know, that dieting is not an individual choice. Mm-hmm. It is on some level, but it also affects other people.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I love the word collective. Like that's, as you were sharing that, like that's the word that was coming up, like the anti-diet space, health at every size, intuitive eating is very much a part of or breeds this like collective energy, like a collective force. Whereas, yeah, dieting is very like breeds individualism. Like, look at my before and after picture. Like, look at all my discipline and my hard work. And a step further, anti-diet, intuitive eating, health at every size recognizes the systemic factors, the social determinants of health. And diet culture often doesn't. They're like, this is all individualistic. Like you were able to achieve these changes, but they aren't saying things like, yeah, you were able to do this because of time, money, you know, access, all these things. Whereas in the intuitive eating, anti-diet, health at every size space, we're looking at like, what are the other factors? And I think that only further helps us like leaning into seeing humanity as like a collective.
Exactly. And when you realize how small your sort of like individual actions really are, that like, you know, like I'll give the example of like, I won't talk about specific numbers, that can be triggering to people. But last year when I had my blood work done, my triglycerides were a bit high. And I have a sort of a family history of high triglycerides. And I made some dietary changes that I was hopeful would be helpful with that, that were non-diet changes. They were just like integrating, adding foods in that would be helpful. I did my triglycerides again, and there's no change in my numbers. And so it's this conversation with my doctor of like, yeah, you know, I've kind of done what I can do. My doctor's awesome. He's a very like anti-diet, like he's a wine provider. And so when I was talking, I've kind of done what I can do. And he sort of said like, yeah, you know, the truth is like, there actually isn't much, you know, that we can do in order to like, you know, make changes in our numbers. Right. And I think to have a doctor say that, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, cause it's like I said, if you read like the Weight Watchers literature, or the Noom literature, it's like, it's all about you and the failures that you've had and the mistakes that you've made. And so I think there's something so incredible about this collective framework. You really see like, no, like this affects a lot of people. Like there are a lot of people who do, you know, who are like in thin bodies, who like, you know, eat very, you know, like very specific ways, who exercise very specific ways, who still have health problems, right? And there are people who are not in thin bodies who don't have health problems. Right. And so really recognizing like any sort of individual like behavior change is not really going to be the thing that changes it for you, I think is also spiritual, of like giving over power of just like, I can only do what I can do. And the rest is really determined by these other factors that have been set in place by the universe, you know?
Yeah. I hear there too, like surrender, like, and and diet culture represents so much resistance, swimming upstream, fighting your natural form, fighting your natural cravings. Whereas intuitive eating, health at every size, is so much about surrendering to like, and not in like a sad way, but in a really beautiful way of like surrendering, acceptance, like all of these pieces that just overall create like less resistance in life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So on the topic of spirituality, I want to talk about, like, I just have never spoke about this with someone, and you and I spoke about it the other day, this idea of like, okay, spirituality is what you define it as. So we're defining it here as like community, collective, being part of a whole, and also living authentically, being connected to your authentic truth. And so I see spirituality all the time, especially like on social media, that I've heard it like almost this defined as like a mix between like pseudoscience and like privilege, like pretty much like, and so yeah. Diet culture often seeps into like that world of spirituality of like, you know, eat clean, your body is a temple. And this is like incredibly harmful. And so I just kind of want to talk about like, how can people spot this form of like diet tainted spirituality and steer clear?
Yeah, I love this question. And I agree with you. I think that like, you know, I'm almost reticent at times to talk about spirituality because I see the problematic ways in which it's portrayed. And I'm like, I don't want to participate in that system, right? And like, I think especially around this whole like clean eating, you know, your body is a temple mentality, you know, I've written some posts about this, and like, I'm sure there's someone out there who will be mad that I'm saying this, but I think that this obsession that we have with like not eating processed food, like when we really look at it and we're honest with ourselves, like it's really just rooted in classism. Like, first of all, everything is processed. Okay. Like, unless you're a raw vegan, you're eating processed food a lot of the day, every day, right? Because cooking is a form of processing. Okay. So everything is processed. We all eat processed food. But the people who are like, oh, you know, clean eating and anything that comes in like a package or a bag, you know, I just think to myself, like, for the vast majority of people, that is not an attainable goal. It is not an attainable goal to not eat processed food. You know, people don't have the time, the money, the resources to prepare food from scratch. And like we said, cooking even is a form of processing, right? So this is not something like the idea of living a clean, you know, clean in quotation marks, lifestyle and eating only clean food is not even a reality that's accessible to the vast majority of people. And more importantly than that, like, it just needs to be said, like, there's nothing inherently unhealthy about processed food.
Yes. Right? Yes.
And so the whole idea that we should avoid them, I really think it's just an us versus them. It's a classism issue more so than it's rooted in any sort of reality. And I always kind of tell people, like, your body is a body. It might be magical, but it isn't delicate. Okay. If you eat a Big Mac, your body's going to be able to handle it.
Wait, pause. It might be magical, but it's not. Wait, what'd you say? It might be magical, but
it's not delicate.
Yes, your body can handle a Big Mac. Your body, like, that's exactly it. Like, your body can handle it. And I've seen those posts before that it's like, we're being told that, like, we can't handle a Big Mac, but we can handle this, like, weird supplement that's been, like, super engineered by, like, you know, the wellness culture to, like, that we're supposed to be having, like, I don't know, this, like, green athletic greens. I always talk about athletic greens. Like, I can't stand it because I see its ads all the time. But I love that you said that it's not delicate. Like it might be magical, but it's not delicate. Oh my God. We need to make shirts. That's amazing.
I love I just think, you know, like I said, like you can totally eat a Big Mac. I've had a lot of Big Macs. I've lived to tell the tale. There's nothing wrong with it.
Right.
Is it the food that feels best in my body? Like, no. So I don't eat a lot of Big Macs.
Yeah.
But like, it's not dangerous.
Totally. Right? Yeah. Evelyn and Elise from of Intuitive Eating, I forget where this, maybe it's in the book, but they have this, I don't even know where I saw this, but at some point they show a picture of Michael Phelps surrounded by like quote unquote processed foods. And it's like, he is performing at such a high level as an Olympic athlete. And he's also eating all these foods. So it's just like an example. I mean, that's an extreme example, but like this idea that it's going to like ruin you and you're not going to like be able to like meet your peak performance. It's like, no, it's just food that provides your body with fuel.
Exactly. And I think too, you know, when you think about something like a Big Mac, one of the reasons why like, again, like I think it's classist to say like, you know, don't eat McDonald's or Big Macs are bad for you is that the same like things that people criticize about Big Macs are the things that make them great for people who are dealing with food scarcity. So like Big Macs are high in calories. They provide somebody with a lot of calories and a lot of fuel to make it through whatever period of time they might have to wait before they can eat again.
Yeah.
You know? And so like, you know, whenever like my kids like really like McDonald's Happy Meals, it's like their favorite thing to go to McDonald's and Happy Meal. So if we ever like go through the drive-thru and I see an unhoused person who's like asking for money, I'm always really happy to be able to give them a meal with like a burger and fries because I know that it will keep them full for a longer period of time than if I handed them a sandwich or
freaking lettuce. Yeah.
So it's like, am I going to order this person who's like unhoused waiting outside McDonald's, you know, the grilled chicken salad, or am I going to order that, you know, the Big Mac and fries? I'm of course going to order them the Big Mac and fries because I want them to have more sustenance. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think like when we're so focused on eating like the fewest number of calories, we kind of miss like there's actually other reasons to eat. And a lot of people don't have the luxury of eating only for the reasons that you may be eating, right? Yeah. Like I only want clean food. I only want fuel. Like, so I just think that like moving away from like villainizing processed foods is super important. And like, you know, like I said, I told my kids eat McDonald's, they eat Goldfish, they eat fruit roll-ups. I totally see that as being a part of a healthy childhood and having a healthy relationship with food is knowing that, you know, all food is okay. There's nothing wrong with any of it, you know?
Yes. This piece about that version of spirituality, that's like my body's a temple, clean food only, really coming down to classist and being classist and elitist, I think really perfectly captures it. And the irony there is like, that is separating from the whole, right? That's like, there's us here who can have like the clean, pure things and do all of the wellness culture things that make us good. And then there's the rest of the people, which is most people in the world who those things aren't accessible to them. And that drives us further apart as like a collective. Whereas the other approach, like of seeing it, is like food is just food and different people have access to different things, need different things in different scenarios. And there's one version isn't better than the other. That breeds this like collective energy, which to me is like true spirituality.
Exactly. Like if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you. And if it's not good enough for you, you have to ask yourself why, right? Like, why do you think it's good enough for other people, but not good enough for you? Mm-hmm. And like, what might be going on for you that's making you feel that way? Yeah. You know, I think you also asked the question of like, how do you know? And I always tell people like my biggest guideline for like, how do you know that you might be on a diet is really straightforward. Like, are they setting rules for you about like how you can eat, right?
Totally.
Because I think any form of food rule, whatever the justification is, like any form of food rule that like everybody on a plan is put on is a form of restriction and is a form of dieting. And so I think anyone who's out there who's saying, yeah, I'm doing like intuitive eating, you know, but like the clean version or like, you know, intuitive eating like for weight loss, like there is no intuitive eating for
right,
you know, insert like right. goal here.
Right.
So that's how I think you can know you're on a diet is like when they're setting rules for you.
Yeah.
Like that is a pretty good indication.
Yeah. And I think where this gets sticky is like often with this like clean eating, spiritual kind of like wellness culture energy, which is like the new age diet culture. There it's not overt. It's very covert. It's like there are no rules, just eat like pure and what feels good for you. But it's like, no, that's still elevating certain foods as morally superior and saying that other foods are morally inferior, which therefore is creating a, you know, kind of subtle rule, not even subtle, but like an unspoken rule that like you should be having X and you shouldn't be having Y.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what is it they say? Like if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. Like I think if they're telling you like you can eat whatever you want, except anything that's unclean or processed or like not pure, then that's a diet.
Right. Man, exactly. Oh, I love chatting. Okay. So these are a few questions that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast. So first is, what is your biggest diet culture pet peeve?
Oh my God. I think my biggest diet culture pet peeve is when people talk about like how bad they are for eating something. You're like, oh my God, I just had a donut. I'm so bad. And I'm like, relax.
Right.
Okay. Like you didn't rob a bank. You didn't hurt anyone. Like just a donut, you know? Yeah. So I think it's like the over like dramatizing of like for me, it's like, if you want to be on a diet and not talk about it, I don't actually really care. Like mm-hmm. you can do what you want, but when you start dramatizing it, that's when I start to find it annoying.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. What does intuition mean to you? And as a part two, how do you experience it in your body?
So to me, intuition, I think another word for it is like knowing, like that's how I think about it. So for me, my intuition is like this deeply held like sense of knowing, and where I feel it in my body actually kind of depends on what it's trying to tell me. And so I noticed when I asked myself that question of like, you know, what do I need right now? When I have more of an emotional need, I feel something kind of in my chest. I might feel like a tightening in my chest muscles, or I might feel like my heart's beating a little bit fast, but I'll feel something there. And that kind of tells me like, okay, there's something that's emotional that's going on for me. When the need that I have is more like hunger based, I really feel it in my stomach. Like I can really feel like a pang in my stomach, like looking for a specific kind of food or a specific amount of food or something like that. And sometimes I feel my intuition more like in my brain, like more psychologically, where I'll ask myself, what do I need? And I'll have a thought, like a really clear thought of like, I need to go for a walk or I need to call my friend. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes it like sort of like comes to me differently.
Yeah.
Maybe depending on what it's looking for and maybe also just depending on what state I'm in.
Yeah. You know? That's such an interesting distinction. Yeah. No one's ever answered it that way, but that resonates for me. Like it depends and it communicates differently depending on what it might be trying to tell you.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Is there anything else on your heart that you're wanting to share with the people, or is there anything that we missed?
We covered a lot of ground. I think the biggest thing that I, you know, hope people will take away from this is, I think one is that there are people like of all sizes out there doing this work. And because I do think that like a lot of people have a perception that like intuitive eating is for thin people, mm-hmm. Or that like it's only thin people who can make this lifestyle work for them. And I'm not thin. And I've been doing this for more than a decade. And I totally think you can do it too, whatever yeah. your size is. So I think that's the main thing I want people to know is that this isn't something that's just available to thin people. And I think the other thing I want people to know, you know, people ask me a lot about like the difference between intuitive eating and any of these other kind of like mindful eating frameworks. And the main thing that I tell people is that in my the way that I practice, the way that I teach about intuitive eating, like it's really not about food. Like food is definitely a piece of it, but food is a tool that we can use, you know, to cope with our emotions, that we can use to work towards liberation, that we can use to work on our relationship with our bodies. But it's a symptom. It's not necessarily the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in intuitive eating, there's really this recognition that there's more to it than just paying more attention when you eat, you know? And I love mindfulness and I love mindful eating. And I think that it's great to learn about, but I think that intuitive eating really provides people with this greater framework of how they care for themselves and their bodies and their emotions. And I think that's what really sets intuitive eating and this kind of process apart. And then I'll put in the plug of like, please, if you want to do intuitive eating, like work with someone who's certified in this approach. Because I just think there's a lot of people out there who, you know, mean well, and maybe even some that don't mean well, that are peddling things that are not intuitive eating. Mm-hmm. So like at a minimum, if you want to do this work, like work with someone who's certified in the approach, if that's not accessible to you, like read the book, that'd be like read the book either way. Mm-hmm. But especially in, but don't settle for working with someone who might not actually be doing intuitive.
Yeah. Yeah. You and I spoke about this too when we spoke the other day of like, sometimes you scroll through a profile of someone who's like claiming to be non-diet or intuitive eating and maybe means well, or like you're saying, maybe doesn't. And you just can get this vibe of like, I don't know. The way I see it a lot is like using your body as a business card of like, there's a lot of body pictures and like almost like a feeling. And it's not fair to say like, this is certainly true, but because we don't know, but like this feeling, and I've definitely experienced this of like, you're not like fully embodying this work. Like, I don't know. It feels like there, and we all have our own internalized biases, fat phobia, all these things. But I just feel like in some cases, there's these sticky situations where someone's like, half in with the work and it feels like it could do harm to people who are seeking to truly be all in with intuitive eating.
Yeah. And I'm all about like, you know, part of this process, learning to trust yourself. So trust yourself. If you're scrolling through someone's content and you're like, wow, this is like supposed to be helping me feel better, but I actually feel terrible.
Yes.
Because this happens to me. Like I, especially as a larger person, like I'll be like scrolling through someone's content. I'll be like, I don't know why, but I feel like I can think of an example of a person who like was pregnant and was talking about how bad they felt in their bodies, who at that moment in time was smaller than I had been since I was like about 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I just had this moment of like, oh my God, it makes me feel terrible about myself. Right. Yeah. And so I'm like, by all means, like, please unfollow. Like, if like, you know, you deserve to like cultivate a social media world of like people who uplift you. And if you want to make like a separate, I sometimes tell my clients, like make a separate Instagram account if you want and just follow.
Totally.
Like anti-diet people who make you feel great, who make you feel powerful. And trust your gut if something feels off about someone. And it doesn't have to be a judgment on them. Like this person's experience of feeling bad in her body was valid. But the way that it lined up with my experience didn't make me feel good. And so her content isn't valuable for me. That doesn't mean her content isn't valuable. And I think we can disentangle and disengage from things that don't make us feel good without passing judgment on the person for what they're doing.
Totally.
But like I said, if someone makes you feel bad, like just don't follow them and don't work with them. Like you can trust yourself. Like this is all about intuition. You can trust yourself.
Yes. And permission to like change your mind too. Maybe you follow someone for a little and then suddenly you're like getting vibes. You're like, no, actually like the last few posts I've seen, this has caused me to feel more self-doubt or insecure than actually been helpful. And then you can change your mind. I take it very seriously. I think of like who I follow is like, if one of my clients or someone was like, oh, I like her work, I want to see who else she respects, and they go to who I follow, I take that very seriously. And I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure people, I do that. So that's why I think about it. If there's someone I respect,
I do the same thing.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, who do they follow? And so I really think of it from a place of like protecting my people or protecting anyone in my community who comes to my profile. And there's many things of like, oh, but like, I feel bad because I know her. And I'm like, I don't feel bad. It's okay. It's okay. Like, because it is a powerful thing to let someone into your like metaphorical feed, your brain feed. And so I take that very seriously.
Yeah. And you know, we've talked a lot about social justice in this episode. And I think, you know, the social justice lens that I would kind of bring to this is to say that like, you know, we talk like we can affect change in this world with like where we put our money, and who we follow on Instagram is like a form
it is of money.
Where we
put our money. Yeah, totally.
Right.
Totally.
Because when we follow them, they get credit, they get clout, they get, you know, potentially ads and partnerships and things like that. So like we may not be able to change. There are people out there who are like co-opting intuitive eating or like using it in ways that like are not accurate. What we can all do as individuals who are committed to social justice is to say like, I'm not going to uplift those people, right? I'm not going to pay for their services. I'm not going to follow them. And like, that's something we can all do as a community. And I do think that, like, I really want to add this plug. I know I said it earlier, but like, I really hope folks listening, like, you know, take a look at who we follow and really try to center and, you know, look at people who have diverse bodies, who are from different ethnic backgrounds, like really trying to like make sure that we are uplifting and centering marginalized voices, as well as, you know, voices of people who look like us, because all of those perspectives are valuable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can say from my own experience is it's been a journey of learning and growing. Like when I first got into this work, I can admittedly say my feed was probably completely, you know, like white girls in smaller bodies like me. And upon learning and peeling back the layers and going deeper and deeper and learning about these deeper social justice issues that are really at the root of diet culture, I grew to realize, okay, like I this is actually so much more than about just like finding people who I relate to. It's also about challenging internalized biases. And part of doing that is here, like listening to other people's lived experiences who don't look like your own.
Exactly. And I think anyone listening who's like, wow, I had no idea about like the racist roots of diet culture. Like, I'm so glad you're listening. And I had no idea either until I learned about it.
Yes.
Right. And I hear you saying the same thing, Leah. Like, I'm like, you know, back when I didn't know better, I wasn't doing the same things I'm doing now. And now I know better and I'm doing my very best. And I think like that's what I say too. Like, you know, in my content, like I try to be inclusive and I really always welcome hearing from folks who feel that my content isn't inclusive or it doesn't speak to them. Like I welcome that feedback as much as I love hearing from people who say it helps them. And I think that, you know, if you don't know anything about this, you're thinking, oh my gosh, there's so much to learn. Like check out the resources we recommended and also know that like, this is a process, right? Like becoming more social justice oriented, becoming more aware, because the people who are using diet culture to oppress people don't want you to be aware of these connections. That's why you're not aware. It's because it's not a highly publicized topic, you know? Right. And so it's okay wherever you're at as you're listening to this, like just the fact that you're open to it and you're receptive and you're wanting to learn more, because almost everyone who I've ever told about the racist roots of diet culture has been like, wow, I had no idea that was a thing.
Yeah.
And it's and totally
there's like
okay
one book on it. Even still, it's hard to know. Like everyone references Fearing the Black Body, Sabrina Strings, Your Body's Not an Apology, Sonya Renee Taylor, like more is more body image centered than like the history and the racist roots. But yeah, it makes sense. You don't know. There's like still are a few resources out there. And yeah, I love this Maya Angelou quote that's like, do the best you can until you know better. When you know better, do better.
Yes, I love that. And I think it's true. And I think there's been, you know, a pretty conscious effort to like, you know, decenter and limit the reach of some of these Black scholars who have created amazing works of scholarship on body image and on how it affects diverse people. But that work hasn't been publicized and seen by as many people. And so I totally agree. Like, if you don't know about it, it's, you know, there's a reason for that.
Right.
And today can be the day that you're like, yeah, now I know about this thing and I'm going to try to do better. And that's an awesome place to be in if that's where you're at.
Absolutely. I could talk to you forever. Like I loved our conversation so much and we'll have to do this again and probably hit different topics. I love
for sure
our flow together.
This was awesome, Leah. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you to learn more about your work?
Yeah. So the best place to find me is on Instagram at Dr. Diana Gordon. And I have a link to my website there. You can also direct message me on Instagram or email me, my contacts on my website. And I'd love to connect. Like I said, love to hear your feedback on my content or hear about offerings you're interested in. Feel free to message me.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Leah.
If you enjoyed this episode, if it inspired you, if you learned something, it would mean so much to me if you rated it and reviewed it. And if you feel called to, share it with someone who it might resonate with. You can find me on Instagram at leahkern.rd. You can also join my weekly newsletter by visiting leahkernrd.com. And I'll see you next week.